And welcome to another edition of the Sea Control Podcast, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. As always, I am your host and president here at SIMSEC, Matthew Hipple. Now, before we get into today's podcast, I do want to put out a small plug. If you have not heard our new podcast, Real-Time Strategy, we'd invite you to go onto iTunes and look it up and subscribe. It's a new series, at least once a month to start, talking about simulations, video games. But today's podcast here at SIMSEC, we are going to discuss the freedom of navigation operations of the USS Lassen and the situation in the South China Sea. There's been some definitional questions brought up in articles by Sam Legrone and Chris Cavas, so USNI News and Defense News. But we'll get into those during the podcast, where we have Ankit Panda of The Diplomat and Timothy Choi, another writer from SIMSEC and a loyal follower of the podcast, and it will be his first time on any podcast anywhere, and we are really glad to have him. But before we get into that, a quick shameless advertisement for SIMSEC from my wife.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. And, like the United States, SIMSEC is and always will be free. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership, which gets you daily emails of our articles and a WordPress account that sends your own writings directly to our editorial staff. However, admin, special projects, software, events, and prizes do cost money. There's a new option to make a voluntary monthly donation at the bottom of every SIMSEC article. No matter how you choose to support us, those who volunteer for leadership, our amazing content producers, our readers, our listeners, our conference planners and attendees, and our financial benefactors, we are incredibly grateful. Remember, Sea Control is more than just a podcast, and SIMSEC is more than just a website. We are a vibrant community built on a passion for discovery and discussion. Sign up, write, donate, comment, or even leave 5 stars on our iTunes page. Join us today.
And we are back. Again, we are here with Ankit Panda and Timothy Choi. And gentlemen, as I've explained to you and as our listeners are well aware, the thing that we like to do here on the podcast is to give you the opportunity to introduce yourselves. So, Ankit, we'll start with you. Go ahead. Tell the audience who you are.
Sure. Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here on the SIMSEC podcast. So I've been editing The Diplomat for just over 2 years, and I've been a little bit of a Asia security international relations egghead for a while. I've been following the South China Sea for about 5 years now, and I've been covering it extensively for The Diplomat. So with the Freedom of Navigation operation, I pretty much exclusively wrote about the South China Sea last week. I think I did about 9 articles alone just on the Lassen op and the fallout from that. So yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot. It's good to be here.
Perfect. And Tim?
Yep. Well, thank you for having me on here. My name's Tim, and I'm here from the University of Calgary Center for Military and Strategic Studies. I'm a third-year PhD student, and while I focus mainly on Arctic affairs and Northern developments in the maritime realm, I found there's definitely some parallels here in the South China Sea that I felt was quite interesting and could definitely comment on.
And I forgot my most important affiliation, which is that I am the New York chapter president for SIMSEC. So if you're listening to this podcast and you're in New York and you're interested in maritime security or are already in SIMSEC, definitely don't hesitate to get in touch with me about any of that.
I'll take that temporary snub as punishment. We did record a version of this podcast yesterday that I'll say was lightning in a bottle, but my MP3 Skype recorder mysteriously stopped recording. So here we are again. So to give you a little background, the major issue is the South China Sea, specifically the Spratly Islands. So as most folks know, China makes some pretty excessive territorial claims when it comes to the South China Sea. You have, on a larger scale, the vague 9-dash line that they declare for their national security, where they make sort of statements that the entirety of the South China Sea is their backyard, and then more specifically within the Spratly Islands. And in the case of the USS Lassen, you have these artificial islands that the Chinese have been building out of the sea. You have the Fiery Cross, the Mischief, and what the Lassen sailed within the 12 nautical mile territorial sea limit was the Subi Reef. And all three of these are being turned into facilities. So before I get into any more specifics, of course, let's turn it over to the guys that we brought here to talk about it in the first place. And Ankit, I'll let you open up.
Perfect, yeah. So let me just talk a bit about the background here. So, you know, I should say, you know, you highlighted that China has been converting these reefs in the Spratlys into facilities of one sort or another. But, you know, I should clarify that Vietnam, the Philippines, the other claimants have done this. In fact, they managed to make moves in the South China Sea, even Taiwan, far before China did, actually, in many ways. The reason that China's behavior is getting so much attention in the press today is because it's at an unprecedented pace and it's at an unprecedented scale. They're simply reclaiming and constructing facilities faster than anyone has and more than anyone has. So Subi Reef has actually been under control by China since the late 80s, when China decided that the South China Sea was something that it had to take a concrete action on. And, you know, just 6 years before that, China had signed on to the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which was concluded in 1982. And we'll talk a bit about that later. I'll let Tim talk about that, since the main conversation tonight is around the legal distinctions there. Now, you know, switching over to U.S. policy, everything that the United States is doing or will do in the South China Sea, basically over the next year or over the next few months, a lot of it comes down to law. It comes down to international law. It comes down to maritime law. It comes down to precedent. It comes down to things like the freedom of navigation, which the United States Navy sees as a public good that it has brought on itself as the only truly global Navy capable of projecting power far and wide to enforce. So it's actually funny because the United States hasn't managed to ratify the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, but yet the U.S. Navy is kind of, if there is a global enforcing force for UNCLOS and customary international law, it is the U.S. Navy. So essentially what China is doing, the United States, you know, the reason this operation occurred wasn't because the United States wanted to flex its muscles and show China that, you know, it's not as great of a rising power as it thinks it might be, that it's not exceptional. That's not the issue. The issue is about norms. It's about laws. So let me talk a bit about the LASANOP, and then I'll pass it over to Tim to talk about the innocent passage versus FONOP distinction. FONOP is freedom of navigation operation for listeners that might not be familiar with that. So on October 27th, last Tuesday, early morning, we're in the South China Sea. Just 24 hours before that, we've seen a report in Reuters and a few other sources from, you know, strategically leaked out of the Pentagon that the USS Lassen, named specifically, will conduct a freedom of navigation operation within 12 nautical miles of Subi Reef. So this is clearly being telegraphed by the Pentagon. They want China to know that this operation is coming, that it's there to assert that Subi Reef has no entitlement to a territorial sea under UNCLOS. And then, of course, October 27th morning, the Lassen does this passage, and that's a bit of a black box when it comes to reporting. There's some ambiguity about what was there. Most reports have said that there was a P-8 Poseidon aircraft monitoring the Lassen, but the aircraft itself did not enter the 12 nautical mile zone. But the Lassen entered, it left, it was escorted by two PLA Navy ships, a frigate and a destroyer. There was no real confrontational behavior by anybody. So now the question that I'll turn over to Tim to discuss is what the Lassen did the Lassen assert high seas freedom when it was within the 12 nautical mile zone of Subi Reef, or did it conduct what's known as innocent passage, which is a specific mode of transit from point A to point B, articulated under Part 2, Article 19 of UNCLOS. And if the Lassen did that, that would actually be a major strategic blunder for the United States, because it could imply de facto recognition of an actual territorial sea. And Tim, I'll pass it over to you to just go over some of the nitty-gritty there from a legal perspective.
Tim, before we go into that, it's important for the audience to know that, you know, these aren't islands in the first place. These are all submerged reefs that at low tide come out of the sea. In UNCLOS, which, by the way, the United States considers to be representative of customary law. So although we're not signatories, the way the United States Navy and the United States government, and I'm not speaking on behalf of them, but the way that they approach it is that these things are customary law, and UNCLOS demonstrates these things, so we reference it. But all of these facilities are built on things that have been reclaimed by what UNCLOS does not consider an island, which is something that sticks out at high tide. Which none of these that I'm aware of apply to, even before you ask the question of who do they belong to in the first place. So it's a two-sided question. Is it an island? No. Two, who owns these outcroppings and territory? Unknown. So there's two questions there. But go ahead, Tim.
Right. No, thank you. So the question here really is about Well, let's take it back a bit. So UNCLOS is this idea of finally having some way to resolve the two opposing views of how do states manage the oceans. And that's basically the idea of Mare Liberum, free seas, versus Mare Clausum, closed seas. And so Mare Liberum, free open seas, you know, the benefit of that is, of course, you have free trade and, you know, everybody benefits. But on the other hand, you also have the issue of national security, which is represented by Mare Clausum. Throughout a long period of history, you know, for centuries, states have been trying to figure out how do we balance these two requirements. And it was only until 1982 when UNCLOS was settled that they decided to find a way to do this. What UNCLOS allowed was that states could have a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. And this is measured from the baseline that, and within this 12 nautical miles, states have the right to require basically that any other nation's warships must operate in peacetime under certain conditions. And this condition is known collectively as innocent passage. It means that a warship from a foreign navy can sail through the territorial waters as expeditiously as possible while not doing a wide variety of activities, such as launching helicopters, turning on fire control radars, carrying out arms exercises, launching drones, and even such mundane activities as fishing and just research. And research is not actually very well defined. But nonetheless, that means that if a territorial sea exists that a particular navy respects that, then it will transit through that area under the condition of innocent passage, subject to all those restrictions I listed earlier. And so what happened during the Lassen voyage is that the Lassen sailed through those 12 nautical miles without launching helicopters, without turning on its major radars, and without carrying any arms exercises or basically doing anything that it would have only been allowed to do on the high seas. The Lassen actually undertook innocent passage. Instead of contesting the Chinese territorial sea, it actually more or less just respected it. And so basically, if you want to contest the Chinese position that those 12 nautical miles are territorial waters, then you need to do something in those claimed waters that is, you know, consistent with what you're allowed to do on high seas. Otherwise, if you're carrying out an innocent passage within these contested waters, then you are basically admitting that those waters are territorial waters belonging to, in this case, China. And of course, that defeats the whole purpose because foreign officers are supposed to illustrate that you think these waters are high seas and not territorial waters.
Yeah. Can I jump in for a second?
Yep.
Just, you know, a small point, just a few clarifications that I'd like to make. So, when we talk about what China has actually asserted in the South China Sea, it's very interesting. You know, I have to emphasize the fact that China keeps things incredibly ambiguous. So China has never actually come out and issued any sort of official map, official statement that asserts using the language of UNCLOS that Subi Reef is understood to be a rock that has a 12 nautical mile territorial sea. So China's never actually said that. So they keep things really ambiguous. I mean, obviously, you know, the poster child for South China Sea ambiguity is the nine dash line. But basically, when it comes to all these features that China has been improving and constructing on in the Spratlys, they keep it very ambiguous. So also, you know, when you look at the Chinese reaction after the Lassen op, it's interesting to note that China didn't actually come out and call the Fon op a violation of its sovereignty. They use language like a threat to our sovereignty, a provocation, a serious, you know, serious potential escalation. And that kind of is funny because, you know, earlier they'd said that we will never allow any foreign country to enter our sovereign waters. So, you know, the way China reacted also is a little bit interesting in this case. And, you know, I mean, you're absolutely right, Tim, that the Fon op, you know, there's a lot of ambiguity surrounding this. You know, since I'm a journalist and an editor, I care a lot about sourcing and about statements being on the record when they come from the government, especially. And the only senior U.S. government official that has said anything about this on the record is Ash Carter himself at a Senate Armed Services Committee hearing when he was asked about it by John McCain. And all Carter really said is essentially, and I quote, "What you read in the newspapers is correct, but I don't want to say any more than that." So who knows what he meant? And, you know, the sourcing on these, you know, I mean, nothing against the U.S. Naval Institute or Defense News, but the sourcing was anonymous, and, you know, you have to kind of wonder, was this official aware of the distinctions between innocent passage and FONOP? And, you know, I think it was, because, like, if you look at what the DoD says about FONOPs, I mean, it's heavily implied that there is a lot of legal consultation and legal experts are involved in making the determination that a maritime claim is excessive and the decision to undertake FONOPs. But, you know, I think there are a bunch of questions here that really will only be answered when, you know, either somebody from the White House or the Pentagon comes out on the record and really tells us what specifically the Lassen did.
That's absolutely true. And, of course, some of the listeners may be wondering, well, what's the big deal about all this? And how, what if China does assert this kind of de facto territorial sea? If America doesn't contest this, what happens then? Well, essentially, the fear, as it were, is that this will become a gradually become a customary international law situation,
yeah,
where the Chinese position becomes enshrined more or less in both state behavior and gradual solidification into the written law and written behavior of some states. And so in order to prevent this kind of normative regime from developing where states treat this illegal expansion of territorial waters, you have to nip it in the bud. And so that's the whole point of why the Americans, the U.S. Navy, have the FONOPS arrangement, both in this particular situation and globally as well. And so part of the requirements for nipping this, you know, this butt nipping, as it were, is to actually make it very clear what your stance is on the issue. You can't sail into this area of water and then carry out activities that may or may not be construed as innocent passage. You have to make it clear what your stance is in order to actually inform the other side that what they're doing is not acceptable. But it's both for the Americans' own interest in preventing such illegal expansion of waters, but also for boosting support of their allies and increasing the regional allies' confidence in America's position on the matter.
And, you know, this is something that the United States is engaged in historically. The Barbary Pirates War was about the freedom of navigation. Part of our entry into World War I was kicked off by unrestricted warfare, which was another freedom of navigation question. You have the Gulf of Sidra exercises against Libya. You have the operation against Iranian excessive territorial claims in the Gulf. And you even have, with the Chinese, you know, we discussed the nine-dash line. Well, there's also the air defense identification zone and U.S. air operations contrary to the claims that they made over the airspace of the South China Sea. Some people may ask that question, why is this important, building this norm of freedom of the seas and the freedom of navigation? But historically, the United States has made one of its strategic priorities the ability to have access to these strategic lines of communications, to generally have the principle of the freedom of navigation. And so that's why these kinds of operations are not only going on, but as you both discuss, the nature of their conduct is also important. And of course, I will say this, that just because, you know, we're talking about the minutiae here, and maybe we're nerding it out a little bit, you know, ships conduct themselves as if they were doing an innocent passage all the time. Fire control radars are not always on. You're not always fishing. You're not always doing flight operations. And this can be a first move towards a more broad campaign. But then, of course, that's the question kind of we ultimately are looking at, is the follow through. And that is where I think we should move the conversation. What do you think the next actions of not only the United States, but China will be in regards to this this continued question of territorial claims in the South China Sea?
Yeah, look, I mean, so you bring up a really good point. You know, like, we are definitely, you know, we're the maritime security nerds. We're going to be digging deep into what this might mean if it is innocent passage. I know a bunch of other people out there are too, you know, experts who study this very closely. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, this is essentially a legal gotcha moment for China. You know, if they pick up on this and they say, hey, the Lassen didn't actually, you know, assert high seas freedom, this is something that we can eventually play on. I mean, you know, something else maybe we can get to later is the fact that the Philippines has actually sued China at The Hague. So there is an international tribunal case currently underway. In fact, just last week, 2 days after the Lassen did its FONOP, the court decided that it had jurisdiction. So now the merits are under consideration, and we'll probably get a decision on that next year. But, you know, ultimately, if I kind of look at how the Chinese reacted to the U.S. operation, because I think that matters too. I mean, I think even if this were an innocent passage, I think the United States gets away with it. And I think that they assert what they needed to assert. And, you know, we've also seen that the Pentagon is going to do these repeatedly, which is a very good sign. I mean, the worst thing would have been for a single FONOP to occur and then us not hearing anything for a year and then, you know, some decision coming out of the court. I think it's good that the U.S. Navy is planning on doing these quarterly. I think twice a quarter is the schedule that they've set out. So that's, you know, something to look forward to. Tim, I'll let you talk a bit more about the U.S. Navy's future plans and details. Matt, do you want me to field the Chinese side first?
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. So I think, you know, I talked a bit about the Chinese reaction and, you know, with the FONOP, I think what's interesting is how China conceives of militarization in the South China Sea. So when Chinese President Xi Jinping was here in his White House Rose Garden press conference with President Obama, what he said was, you know, China will never militarize the South China Sea. And, you know, I work as a diplomat. We've been writing a lot on the militarization of these islands. We're like, yeah, okay, that's convincing, especially when you're, you know, implanting, you know, setting up radar facilities, helipads on these reefs and stuff. But, you know, that's not what China means when they're talking about militarization. I mean, again, this is something that they keep ambiguous. China's never issued any sort of official document that says this is what militarization means. But essentially it means, you know, things like a FONOP, like any sort of like kinetic military action in the area. And, you know, China has been flying jets. So, I mean, right after the Lassen's op, they flew jets from Woody Island and the Paracels to kind of, you know, flex their muscles a bit. I don't think we'll quite see an air defense identification zone in the South China Sea like we did in the East China Sea, but that's a separate conversation for a whole other podcast maybe. You know, I think we're going to see China double down on its efforts for reclamation, not only because the FONOPs are underway and China can now say that the U.S. made the first move, so we're going to defend our sovereign waters or our territory, but also because this case at The Hague is a bit of a ticking time bomb for China, because once a decision comes out and, you know, I, you know, based on what I've read by people far smarter than me when it comes to issues of maritime law, and, you know, I'm not a maritime lawyer. I should have probably said that at the beginning of the podcast. If you're making any sailing decisions based off of what I've said tonight, that's probably a bad idea. But, you know, just based on the outcome of that court case, I think what we're going to see is, you know, China will either have to comply, in which case that's great, you know, and whatever that means, you know, I mean, compliance is obviously another issue. How is China going to comply when it's already set up these facilities, when all these other claimants in the South China Sea have set up their outposts and facilities? But, you know, if it doesn't comply, it's in transgression of international law, and that's a really important moment. You know, the moment China is this great rising power, which is so concerned about saving face and appearing responsible on the international stage, is in direct violation of an international court ruling. I mean, this, you know, the decision on jurisdiction was unanimous, and if it's unanimous again, you know, that's going to be a very bad sign. And also, you know, I'll just talk very quickly about the public opinion issue, which I also think is interesting. You know, there is a very vocal minority in China who follow the South China Sea issues. They saw this FONOP occur and they're like, wow, the United States is kind of, you know, throwing this in our face. We need to be strong. We need to, you know, double down on our claims to the South China Sea. And look, I mean, honestly, based on what I've read on, you know, how these disputes are perceived in China from a public opinion perspective, I mean, it is clear as day if you're a Chinese citizen that the South China Sea is Chinese sovereign territory and has been. You know, this isn't something that the Chinese elites are just interested in or trying to acquire in a strategic move. I mean, there is really a deep-seated nationalist belief that this is rightfully ours. And, you know, after a century of humiliation or whatever, China is now a great power and, you know, it needs to assert its rightful place in the world. And part of doing so is, you know, claiming these waters and these territories that all these other peripheral states in Southeast Asia claim are theirs, but are really truly China's, because China is, you know, the Middle Kingdom and the greatest state in the area. So, you know, I think that there's a little bit of that as well. And, you know, the CCP leadership has to be sensitive to that. Even if they, you know, and I think they recognize the subtleties here, they have to be sensitive to the public opinion issue.
Especially when you talk about how nationalism is basically a genie that they've, you know, released off the bottle. You can't really put that back in, right? And yeah, China is an authoritarian country, and so, you know, it's a lot less, in theory, vulnerable to public opinion. But on the other hand, it cannot be ignored, and specifically given the internal structure of China and this development, I'm thinking that they will take a greater interest in how their own population perceives them. So we can see the influence of domestic interest in determining foreign policy outcomes, and we see that we saw that back between the Danes and the Norwegians over fishery economic zones before UNCLOS came about, and they were prevented, despite the presence of political will, from actually arriving at a satisfactory conclusion because of their own fishermen's own interests. So we may see something similar here in this particular case as well.
Let me jump in real quick there before we lose that moment, because of that issue about saving face. I think that there was a unique opportunity with the Chinese port visit down in Florida. If we want to talk about losing face, if the Chinese had done anything untoward with the last passage through their vague 12 nautical mile limit, then they would have been kicked out. I don't think we have any doubt of that. And I think that may have given leeway to open this first escalatory move. But so we kind of leveraged this moment in time where it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't for the Chinese, and they chose that kind of moment down there in Florida over a higher level of escalation in the South China Sea. And that's why I think you saw some of those Chinese comments coming on about how relationships between the United States and Chinese navies have never been better. Before I go on, Tim, please.
Sorry, just wanted to add one point that I remembered. Sorry, Tim, I promise after this I will close my mouth. You know, when I was researching the Lassen story as it happened, I was very curious, you know, why this ship? And, you know, as I was doing some research, I found out that the Lassen's crew is actually very experienced in interacting with their PLA Navy counterparts, and specifically under the April 2014 Code for Unplanned Encounters at Sea. So that, again, you know, shows that the United States has been very careful here, that, you know, we want to have sailors that know how to interact with their PLA Navy counterparts. We don't want any sort of unintended escalation. So I think both sides are very conscious of that. I just wanted to add that. Tim, go ahead.
Right, that's right. So as for the Americans' future responses, I think you can definitely see, well, for me, most interestingly, as a proponent of the littoral combat ship, I expect to see as a kind of test, as it were, is a minimally armed peacetime enforcement vessel, is that suitable for this kind of mission, a FONAUT mission, which is, of course, very much a peacetime forward presence mission. And to what extent does the perception of its capabilities matter in terms of how successful it will be for carrying out FONAUTs? And the U.S. will be based, have been and will continue to be basing the LCS out of Singapore, and missions such as the one that last undertook will very likely be one of the major missions that they'll undertake within in the coming years. Having such a vessel sailing within the 12 nautical miles in the face of shore defenses and much more heavily armed Chinese vessels, will the Chinese be willing to be a little bit more aggressive depending on the type of ship that is being used for these FONAUTs?
When it comes to what the United States is doing as well, the Reuters report came out saying that there'd be at least two more of these kind of operations coming up, and it sounded on Kit like you have heard some stuff that there may be a regular drumbeat schedule. But earlier we had mentioned Secretary Carter was the only one who had spoken on the record about these operations. He apparently will also be joining the carrier in the South China Sea soon, which is interesting, and perhaps it will coincide with one of these FONAUT missions. It would be especially interesting to see how this was conducted, especially if the Secretary of Defense was on the carrier at the time one of the ships under the carrier were to conduct a FONAUT, because I think that would send quite a message. I mean, you don't necessarily need the Secretary of Defense himself to drive on a ship through the 12 nautical mile limit, but it'll be interesting to see the dynamic and how they use his presence with the carrier strike.
You know, just on that point, you know, things are a bit diplomatically raw right now. I don't know if you heard, but after the ASEAN Defense Ministers Plus meeting, they weren't able to issue a joint statement, which is, you know, shows how bad things are right now. You know, China simply refused because they wanted to mention the artificial islands, and, you know, Carter was there. So, you know, it's, you know, I think diplomatically things are fragile, and it might take a little bit more time for things to settle down before maybe Carter or Obama can make a strong stand on this matter. But hey, you know, just one final note is that, you know, we talk about the U.S. pivot to Asia. FONAUTs are a great way to make friends. When you have states like the Philippines, Vietnam, we're so concerned about these artificial islands. You know, Philippines is a U.S. ally. Vietnam is a U.S. partner. You know, these states are looking to the United States to do things like this. And this is the kind of stuff that enforces resolve. The pivot has received a lot of criticism, but it's never too late to pick up things like FONAUTs and really demonstrate that the United States is committed to Asia.
Right, especially how China likes to divide, prevent ASEAN from actually banding together to come up with very strong collective actions. China does prefer to use bilateral relations among the ASEAN states to split them apart, basically. And so if the ASEAN states does have, you know, say, the U.S. on the other side to help them come to a collective, build common interests, as it were, then perhaps it will become a much more, you know, strong, powerful, if you want to say, call it that way, collective group for action.
Well, gentlemen, I think that's a tight 30 minutes. So before we call it, we'll give each of you an opportunity to close out either with an observation about the discussion that we've had today. Of course, the opportunity to plug something that you're working on or that you think our audience should go and seek out to inform them about these kinds of issues. Ankit?
Well, thanks again, Matt, for having me on the podcast. Been a long-time listener. I will plug my own podcast over at The Diplomat, so if you like the sound of my voice, there's a lot more of that over at The Diplomat. I also write there regularly covering maritime issues in East Asia, among other things. I also write about South Asia, Northeast Asia, North Korea, all sorts of things. Just interested in security broadly. I'm also working on a book chapter on Japan's role in the South China Sea that should be out soon. The cliff notes of that is that Japan is probably not going to do much in the South China Sea. But a final observation would be that, you know, a lot of what we talked about today, you know, a lot of the ambiguity can be cleared up if the U.S. government just comes out and tells us, you know, in clear terms that this was a FON op and not an innocent passage issue. And I think, you know, we can maybe look forward to that. Thanks.
Absolutely. Tim?
Yep. Thanks again for having me on. And, yep, the closing point, of course, is that the United States Navy does have to make the positions very clear. And there's no better proof than perhaps, you know, a photograph or video of some helicopters taking off or, you know, a list of some or turning on last since AIS. So people can actually follow where it was to prove its track through those waters. So that's basically the main takeaway I'll put out there. As for anything else, well, the University of Calgary is up here in Alberta, Canada. We're putting out our 18th annual Graduate Strategic Studies Conference. So if you're a graduate student and you have anything related to strategic studies, security, defense, feel free to submit your abstract to us by December 2nd. And our conference is in February 25th to 26th. And you can find more details about it on strategyconference.ca.
Tim, I think your point is an incredibly strong one to close out on. Specifically, we discussed earlier in the podcast that China uses the vagueness of its language as a weapon. And what we've come to the determination, I think, is that the United States' greatest weapon is its clarity, is absolutely being very clear about what it is doing and what it intends and what its stance is. So whatever the vague language on the side of China may be, the rest of the international community can see absolutely what it is not allowed to be. Gentlemen, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast, and I'm sorry I had to drag you out late at night to do this for a second time. And you know what? I have to correct myself. At the beginning, I said that Tim had not been on a podcast before, but that was wrong. He was on a podcast yesterday, one that I failed to properly record. So you are now a veteran of podcasting, Tim, and we are happy to have you. But absolutely, both of you, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Thanks a lot, Matt.